and now we go to Q&A, and I'm going to start with Judah. Judah, my first question for you is, which of the University of Chicago owner's restrictions upset you the most, and that really encouraged you to take the gap year?
So for me, the thing that struck me the most was the education component. In the email, it was written that any professor, for any reason, they didn't really have to give a reason, they could just decide if they wanted to, could go completely online. And so the feeling was, I talked to the few people I know going there, and the feeling was that most, if not all, my classes would be online, and I would be studying out of my dorm.
So you made the decision to you were going to live on at the dorms no matter what? You weren't going to work from home?
No. I decided to live on the dorms just because I talked it over with my parents, and we both decided that it would be better for me to be out of the house.
I get that. And what is it about the online experience that you thought was going to be problematic? Did you think you wouldn't learn as much, it wouldn't be as fun? What was it that bothered you?
So for me, when I took, so CPS, Chicago Public Schools, went online after COVID hit Chicago pretty hard, and there was a sizable difference between classes in person and classes online. When you're in person, you can stay after class and ask a teacher a question. You can come in early and ask a question. When the teacher doesn't fully understand your question or when you don't fully understand an explanation, it's much easier to communicate that. Whereas if you're trying to explain something online, A, teachers have very strict office hours, and a lot of times I found that my teachers weren't available. So that was definitely a concern with online classes at UChicago.
Going to this gap year job you took, what is the appeal? Is it the fact that it's in Israel? Is it the fact that it's an ambulance service? What's the real appeal here?
Yeah, so the biggest appeal for me is that I'm actually in an ambulance. A lot of medical gap year programs you don't get the firsthand experience. You're either in a classroom or you're helping file data, and maybe you get to see a surgery here and there, but you're not really in the thick of it. Whereas with the Aardvark Magen David Adom program, you're in an ambulance. It's you, it's a paramedic, and you're responding to 911 calls.
And do you think that these ambulance experiences will be highly relevant to your medical training?
Of course I do. There's really, you know, like I mentioned before, when you're learning about something, it's one thing, but when you're actually experiencing it, when someone is, God forbid, bleeding out, and you have to know exactly what am I supposed to do, how do I help this person, that's why you go to medical school, to learn that, among other things. And so having that experience before going to medical school, I think will serve me tremendously.
A couple of months ago, we had Jordan Shiner on the show, and he was debating how to open up Camp Horseshoe. You were planning to be a counselor at Camp Horseshoe. Horseshoe opened because of restrictions placed by the county. How did you take it, and how did you end up spending your summer?
So I was pretty devastated. Not so much for me. Obviously, I was incredibly excited to be back for another summer on staff. It would have been my 10th year there. But also, I was devastated for specifically all the campers and Cabin 14ers. I know Jordan and Camp Horseshoe remedied the lost summer with a sailing trip and a week at camp, but it really isn't the same as being able to be leaders in the camp. So I really felt horribly for those kids. So during the summer, you know, I've tried to spend a lot more time with my family. I know we were really locked together in quarantine, as you can imagine, for 3 months, but we took a few road trips together. We spent time, you know, going on hikes, being in the wilderness that we really haven't had the opportunity to do. I was working with two of my really close friends from camp, Nati Lewis and Andrew Lux. I was helping them out. They were running a basically summer camp light where we would do activities with city Horseshoe kids. And so I was helping them out periodically with that. And that really ate up a lot of my time during the summer.
Great. Thank you, Judah. Let's move on to
our
next speaker. And good luck in Israel, and have a great time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Our next My first, so next question goes to Jennifer Bloom. Jennifer is the College Admissions Counselor. Jennifer, in your book, you highlight and you discuss today this idea of a spike. As I interpret it, that means in your application, you want to tell a story about yourself, and you need to add details to this narrative. Now, you're suggesting that COVID is giving an opportunity to give you more time to be more selective as to how you build that spike. You gave some examples of it. I know that a lot of kids are sitting around not being particularly active in building their stories. How do you get them to get up and go to work and really pursue what are, they want to make is their interests?
Yeah, so my strategy for admissions is really deciding that, it really can be summarized as the idea of be alike but spike. So that means that students need to fit in or perform at least as well as other students on certain metrics like grades, standardized testing, and some in-school leadership. But since 80% of applicants to college are typically academically qualified for that school, they have the right grades and test scores, successful applicants also have kind of an area in which they stand out or spike in a specific area. And it can be in anything from, you know, veterinary medicine to, you know, a budding economist to photography, theater, you know, art history really are the range of different areas. So most students kind of, when they start to first work with me, they understand this kind of the strategy. And, you know, I guess my encouragement would be, you know, if you genuinely enjoy, you know, this spike, and a spike should be something that you obviously genuinely, authentically enjoy pursuing, then, you know, it's about brainstorming ways that you can continue to pursue it with these restricted conditions. So, you know, clearly there are some, you know, some service work has been really, really challenging because, you know, a lot of the community centers are closed and a lot of the kids that are kind of most underserved, they don't have Wi-Fi in their homes and they don't have tons of devices to use and they're not able to access over Zoom. So really it's about being creative and maybe it's doing outdoor classes. Maybe it's, you know, finding different ways to explore your spike and realizing that maybe that, you know, community-centered service work is going to have to wait until the spring, you know, hopefully before. But, you know, those are the kinds of conversations I'm having with students typically on a daily basis. And there are a lot of really creative ways to continue to kind of build your area of interest, explore it under these conditions.
Now,
does that answer your question?
That's fine. A lot of kids are going to take a gap year this year.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, it's around 5 to 10% of all the students. But a bunch of kids also maybe taking a year off who are not freshmen, but sophomores, juniors, et cetera. It's like a lot of kids are going to be coming through the pike here. Will that make admissions even much more difficult than usual with these campuses going to have this huge increase of additional people coming in? Are the kids who are taking freshman gap years taking the spots of seniors this year?
You know, there's no way around this question, and because, as I said in my talk, you know, what's eminently clear when you speak to these admissions officers, gappers are privileged kids. So will they have an impact on, you know, fall 2021 admissions? It's definitely possible. I know some colleges are really aware of this, and they've said they're increasing freshman class size to counteract the impact of gappers, but others aren't. So, you know, I think that it's, you know, I think applying ED to a reach, but a realistic reach, is something that's probably more important than ever this fall.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. My next question is for Jeremy. Jeremy, you just listened to 11 young people talk about how they're taking on the world. And your talk was about two types of swimmers. You call it the strong swimmers and the weak swimmers. When you just listened to 11 strong swimmers, what do you make of their strengths and how they've been able to counteract? And I didn't invite any weak swimmers on the call. How would you contrast what you've seen today versus what else exists out there?
Yeah, once again, phenomenal question. It boils down to the combination of external, internal factors. These really good swimmers are creative. They have resources. They have, I think Judah commented that his dad gave him some really good feedback. It was really sound feedback. And just being able to give them the confidence to do different things and to lean into the oddity and the I don't know what's next, but I'm going to try it anyway, because some of their core realities are actually really strong. And so the difference between the kids who do struggle, whether I'm working with them one-on-one or there is some resource in their lives that they can anchor onto, can make a difference. Let's say they're an athlete. They have to continue practicing their craft. Let's say they are a dancer, but they don't have tons of financial support. Is there a way for them to continue to dance? Is there a way, plenty of musicians out there of all levels, to continue to play their instrument? The things that they do, that the not-so-good swimmers, I'm just encouraging them to make sure that they are still doubling down on those skills that they do know how to do and not give up on that. Those make a big difference as opposed to just kind of the giving up mentality or I just don't know what to do. So that's a difference. The ones who really can swim that we're listening to today really are implementing many of the things. Even your son was like, yeah, I'm starting to ride my bike now. I mean, that was one of the, I couldn't do this, but now I'm able to do that. And so that attitude is really what the good swimmers are able to do. But the ones who struggle really need to hear it from leaders, whether it's their parents or a grandparent or a teacher, to kind of keep that encouragement up and make sure they're doing the things that they did know how to do and don't give up on those things they do well.
Hi, Jeremy. This is Rick Banks. Let me jump in with a quick question here. These are very useful strategies, and it's a useful overview. From the mental health perspective, are there long-term consequences of COVID for young people that you're worried about or see signs of now?
Unfortunately, for some, yes. And what it is, it's a kind of a built-in negativity. And so what happens is, different theories as to how the mind works, and one is in the kind of a self-efficacy model. Once you start believing you can't do something, you start applying that to everything. And then if your life is struggling, you can then say, look, I'm struggling because of COVID. I'm just now not going to try. And that is really oppressive. And so the idea is to find those little nuggets that allow people to kind of capture one or two positive steps and keep expectations reasonable. We're trying to get through this. The truth is we're going to get through it. I don't know what it's going to look like in a year, but we're all trying to predict. But to Rick, to your point is, I believe the not overly investing and making that negativity part of your narrative, part of your entire theme, like, oh, it's just not going to work, and I don't have to do much right now. Yeah, and then you're going to come out in a year, 2 years, where everybody's going to keep accelerating, and they're going to be kind of just really struggling. And so it's really to make sure we're focusing on a couple small positives and really focus on that to make sure they just don't take on the identity that just nothing's going to work, just that defeatedness. And that's the areas that I'm focusing on with the kids, well, not only kids, but the young adults who are struggling, not to overly attach to that negativity.
That is great. Those are great insights. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick.
Jeremy, we'll go back to the bad swimmers. They were living in a specific, behaving in a certain sets of norms in a certain environment, and they were struggling. And when the norms get changed and when, you know, life is turned upside down, it kind of gives them another bite at the apple. How many of the people you're dealing with who were struggling previously have been able to kind of reorient themselves and get themselves out of this rut?
You know, I don't know, like, a percentage-wise, but what I can say is what I am is I'm a realist and I'm always hopeful, and that's part of my DNA. But what happens is the kids who are struggling or the young adults who are struggling that get one piece of hope or optimism, it could be a supervisor or it could be a friend, that one little nugget, it can help pull them out. And I think, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I find that when they are down, when they are struggling, that don't underestimate that kind act, that reaching out to someone, checking in on someone, just saying, hey, thinking of you, those things matter. And you don't know they matter until a year later when they said, man, I was in a dark place, and the fact you pinged me, you threw me that text just to check in, that just was that little piece that helped out. I'm not asking everybody to be responsible for everyone else. I'm just saying that if you have a positive vibe and you want to throw a little positive vibe someone's way, do it. It makes a difference. So that giving nature can really help the people who are struggling. And then sometimes they get that one little piece of energy, and that breaks them out of that cycle. And then all of a sudden, they're applying for that extra job, and then bam, they get that job, and now they got some built-in structure. Then they got income. So it's kind of a grit. It's kind of like, don't give up, and don't give up on others who are also struggling.
Next question is for Anna Schell. Anna, you talked a little bit in your discussion about mental health for some of your peers. What is your perception among your peer set of things that young adults are doing well to succeed, and where some people might have mental problems?
Yeah, for sure. So I think I mentioned it briefly, but I think trying to maintain that support network is just utterly vital. So I think, and this can be really hard to initiate for sure, but reaching out to people when you need help is really important. And I've noticed you don't need to be explicit, but if you're feeling lonely, you know, you're stuck in your room on a Friday night thinking about, you know, all the things you could have been doing if times were normal, and you just kind of feel that sense of spiral, just text someone, call someone, reach out. Communication here, I mean, this is really cliche, but it's really key. So I've noticed that for my friends has been just super helpful in them kind of just maintaining a positive outlook and like healthy, like, you know, healthy patterns and practices. But I think for sure, just letting yourself like sit and stew within your head. We already have way too much time thinking alone, alone in our room. So I think connecting with others is just so important.
Audrey, I wanted to follow up something that you were talking about with regard to normal behavior during college. When you said you were on 4 hours sleep and having a hangover, and now you're home and you have a very happy and strong family life. I think you're getting more sleep and you're less stressed. When you talk to your peer set, what are you hearing about their mental health and their ability to just kind of slow things down and take a breath and enjoy?
So it's actually interesting. What I've found is there's really two groupings among my friends. There's either people who have really increased their unhealthy habits exponentially or just cut out all their unhealthy habits completely. So for instance, I found that some people have completely quit drinking, quit smoking, and quit doing the destructive things that they were kind of became habit during college. Then I've also seen the flip side where people have been very unhealthy and have been basically drinking throughout the entire day. And I've seen terrible mental health consequences from that. So I think part of the thing that's so vital in maintaining your mental health is just acquiring new healthy habits that really aren't encouraged in college. And I think quarantine's given a unique opportunity for young people like myself to kind of start a new healthy lifestyle.
Jeremy, could you comment a little bit about that, about drinking and smoking and what's being out there?
Audrey just nailed it. That was really on point. And you don't always know in advance who's going to lean towards like getting it together versus some who are just going to start to kind of get swallowed up. And so I think the challenge is if someone is in that dark place, if you see your friends who are just going to continue to just fight the realities they're in, and they're going to continue to drink, they're going to continue to smoke, they're rebelling. They're saying, no, this is my way. This is what I want. That's going to be a mess. That's going to be a car crash. And sometimes, you know, intervening on them, it's more the people who are like trying to reach out and trying to do better. And that's not so easy. So there's definitely that split. You kind of get the bell curve. You get excuse the analogy, but the kind of flattening of the bell curve where you're actually seeing kids who struggle more, and the kids who do well are like, yeah, now I'm going to actually exercise. I'm actually going to start eating better. So again, I think you can't reach everyone, but to the last two speakers who are saying, it's not only reaching out to them. If you need help, you have to find help. That's the goal. And that's not the easiest thing. But if you see your friend struggling, say something positive, or actually get them to do something that's different than drinking. Like, let's go for that walk. Let's get outside in the sun. Let's go take that run. Those things add up. So I think it's really supporting each other as much as possible.
I want to move to Charlotte for a second. Charlotte, you said something really interesting about what makes a successful online experience and what makes an unsuccessful online experience. And your high school, Stanford Online High School, you said was really successful, and Vanderbilt's spring semester was not very successful. And it was because there was both no student buy-in and no faculty buy-in. Charlotte, what do you think is going to change in the fall semester to get either faculty or student buy-in? And have you noticed anything different in your first 2 weeks as it relates to that? Are people more excited about the technology, or is it going to be more of the same?
It's a combination. So in the first week, I actually have seen some improvements from the last semester. Something that I thought of to discuss prior to the semester starting is how schools need to work more to encourage their students to be kind of facilitators of this change and to work to have this be more of a permanent, positive mindset. And what I've noticed is that they actually have done that. And so, for example, in almost all of my classes in this past week, they've reached out with either a survey or in class and are asking students, how is this going to be best for you? What should I do to make this learning experience most positive? How do you learn best? Obviously, this isn't something that people are used to. So the teachers are trying to adapt, which is really reassuring to see. And the students are getting better. I feel like still a bit of a struggle on our end. We are in a hybrid format, so I'm lucky to be back on campus. But students are having kind of a negative mindset, too, that it could be better. We could be fully on campus. Things could be back to normal. So while the professors are doing better on their end, I believe, I think it's a matter now of students taking it into their own hands and realizing, you know, as Jeremy and Anna both said too, we should be lucky that we're here and we should feel grateful that we have this opportunity. And we're kind of in an exciting field of new change here. This is maybe just a little bit more sudden than we realized, but I believe that online school was kind of something that was inevitable. So, I mean, it's all about accepting the positive side of this and working with it and moving forward.
Hannah, this is my daughter, Hannah. Hannah, you mentioned the difference between the spring semester and summer. And I'm wondering why the summer programs were so much better than the springs. You mentioned, I know, for example, that the people who had the most trouble were some of the elderly faculty members who couldn't adapt to the two technology. And I think that your summer school teachers were either grad students or very young faculty who were maybe more in line with this, Zoom and online education processes. Why do you think the summer was so much better than spring? Was it student buy-in? Was it the faculty buy-in? What made it better?
I think it was a mix of all of those things. I think the biggest aspect was the fact that these courses were made for an online format, and every activity we did was made so that for the format. But it was also definitely student buy-in. I resonated with a lot of what Charlotte said. During the summer, I knew what I was signing up for and appreciated the fact that it was going to be online versus in the spring where it was kind of thrust upon me and I wasn't as willing to commit to this new format.
Okay.
This is Rick Banks. Larry, let me follow up with a question for your daughter. So this is for Hannah, Charlotte, and Audrey, the current college students. So you all are all not on campus because your dorms are not open. But what if the dorms were open? I'm interested in how would you balance the desire to have a social life on campus on one hand against the possibility of becoming ill and contracting COVID on the other. So if the dorms were open, Would you move in? Do you think lots of your friends would move in? And then how do you think people would behave and why? Would they engage in social distancing, or would they see social distancing as unrealistic or undesirable given the loss of social life it could entail? So Charlotte, Hannah, or Audrey?
Yeah, I
this
mean,
is Charlotte. I'm sorry, Hannah, go ahead.
Well, you already see at Penn, there's currently an Instagram group called Irresponsible Penn that has been taking pictures of students partying in houses off campus. And I definitely don't think it's a surprise. I feel like if there was dorm living, you would see the exact same thing. It's kids being not exactly responsible. I do think, you know, it might be worth it for the social experience, especially for freshmen who don't know anybody, but it is a touchy situation.
This is Charlotte. I want to jump in just because Vanderbilt does give students the option this year to live on campus. Especially for the freshmen, too, they're actually required to live on campus. Typically, students have to live on campus all 4 years, but they did provide upperclassmen with the option to live off campus. I chose to live off campus, but I did want to be nearby. So I'm here, but a lot of students are in the dorms. And so far, knock on wood, it has been a positive experience. I have heard of absolutely zero parties on campus. Maybe I'm out of the loop, but I actually think everyone has been following it very responsibly. The administration has also been very strict and said that they will expel anyone if they find that they've been breaking the rules here about COVID, you know, guidelines, social distancing, whatever. But I think the students have respected that, and so far it's been very positive. People are still getting together, still socializing, but they're doing it responsibly.
Hi, this is Audrey. Oh, sorry. Just jumping in super quickly. I think another thing that's difficulty in weighing that aspect is something that's sometimes forgotten about is how isolating it feels when you're in a college campus away from family, especially during Corona. Not that that would necessarily lead to parties, but definitely large group gathering. You see this a lot in freshmen where it's very hard to kind of be by yourself. So I think that that would definitely play a large piece into the likelihood of social gatherings, not really a matter of wanting, but more of a need for connection.
All right, next question is for my son, Jonathan. Jonathan, a little less than 2 days ago, Northwestern announced that they were not going to allow for dorm living at Northwestern. We had signed you up to live in a dorm. How did you react to it? What is your current plan? How are you going to adjust to this restriction?
I was pretty devastated, but it was an outcome I expected. So I took the proper precautions. I got an apartment right next to Northwestern, about 100 feet off campus. So that's what most freshmen and sophomores are doing, and that's what my next 4 months are going to look like.
And maybe to follow up with Hannah, you live at Domus, which is an off-campus apartment because the campus dorms are closed. Again, it's a few hundred feet from campus. How many of your friends live in the building? I know one of the Haganis, Mark Hagani, is living in the building. Is it a party? What's going on? Do you view yourself as a pod? What is the how is the building or this synthetic dorm life been like?
I just recently moved in, so I didn't get a chance to really see what it was like, but I was definitely shocked to see how many students were there. When I was moving in, I was moving in with like at least 20 other students, and there was young people everywhere. But I do get the feeling that it's a pod where, I mean, people social distance, I guess, together, but definitely a very social environment. Hopefully with the correct precautions.
Yeah, I hope so, too. All right. I want to talk with Lauren Teichholz next. Lauren, when I was at Penn in the mid-1980s, my professor, Walter Licht, would say in class how bummed out he was, how politically inactive we were. We were keeping our heads down, all of us, or many of us, trying to get Wall Street jobs. And he said that when he was our age, he was demonstrating in the streets against the Vietnam War or for other political causes. What is it about this TikTok that is different that allows for this echo chamber of political activism? How are you and your friends participating? How does it make you feel? And do you think it's good or bad? What do you make of this whole thing?
I think that Gen Z is like a very politically active generation. I'm not quite sure why. I think we've seen, I mean, we came after the millennials, and I think a lot of people saw the millennial generation as not being as active and wanted to do something to fix that. I also think having a platform like TikTok, which is almost exclusively used by people in Gen Z, makes it easier to just communicate across a generation. But I'd say overwhelmingly, I think of it as a good thing, because I think that, I mean, not to like toot our own horns, but like I think that we've made a really big change, and a lot of people in Gen Z really pride ourselves on being the generation that's going to want to make real change.
Okay. Let's transition the discussion a little bit. We've spoke a lot about dorm living and class living, and we now have some young adults who are out in the real world working, but just not in an office. So, Kyle Rosenbluth, I'm going to start with you. You know, you said you were working up in Alberta, you were working on your film, and then you ended up, above the garage, probably, in your parents' house in Jackson Hole with your buddy, working on the film. How did that make you feel? If you just have one close friend, like your partner, was that enough socially to feel comfortable? And when you're working 100% on your work, and you got to walk around outside in that beautiful setting in Jackson Hole, was that sufficient, or did you feel some sense of loss?
Yeah. Well, I guess the first thing I'll say is that my business partner, Daniel, who's also my best friend, has been my closest friend since college. And we've spent a lot of time together. So to us, it was kind of nothing new or unusual. And I think, it did help us with our work in a sense, but in other regards, I definitely missed the socialization with other people. It's really nice to be able to hang out with other people and talk to other people. And I think I was very lucky to be out here, and we have a few friends out here, but, it's definitely not ideal and what I was expecting coming out of college. But we adapted.
And the creative arts that you're in is sometimes a very solitary work. And so you in that editing room, it's just, the two of you, which I think is, I imagine, would be like. What are your personal next steps? Are you going to write another screenplay? And then how are you going to, get this, your film out there?
Yeah, so as I discussed a bit in the talk, we're now in the final stages of raising our last bit of funding and submitting to film festivals that will happen in kind of the winter and early spring. The delay on these festivals for when you have to submit and when they actually happen is quite large. So there is a period of time in which we'll continue writing, working on new screenplays, and hopefully, as things slowly start to open up a bit more, get some actual production and shoots on the calendar.
And you talked briefly about the changes in the film festivals. I've gone to some of these film festivals. The film I wanted to see was sold out. I wait in long lines. Maybe I'd see one show. It doesn't seem like it was made for the consumer at all, but you heard that the film festivals were really a way for filmmakers to market their films to, broadcasting, people who buy films. How do you imagine film festivals will change going forward?
I think I still see them as largely being a industry event and kind of an opportunity for new and upcoming filmmakers to showcase their work in a place where otherwise it would have no venue to be seen. But I said briefly, and I think it does have good benefits for the consumer and the viewer. Someone who wants to go to these film festivals and see these films can now do it online, and there's no capacity, you know, there's no kind of physical theater that limits the number of people. There's no waiting online. I think for a film lover or someone who wants to take part in these festivals, the online move can actually serve some benefit.
Next question is for Jess. Jess, I was talking to your dad the other day, and he said that he had a dinner with Michael Corbat, who is the CEO of Citi. And Vic asked, Mike, you know, how is your life different? And he said, my life is better. I used to be on a plane nearly all week going to visit clients. Now I get to hang out in my office and enjoying a beautiful view of a mountain in Jackson Hole. But the real losers are the young people who don't have a decent apprentice program, who can't learn from some of the older and wiser professionals they work with. You mentioned that you were still learning. How common is KKR doing something right that you're learning so well? What are you hearing from your peers? How much decline in productivity and learning are you experiencing? What are you hearing among your peer set?
Yeah, good question. I am definitely incredibly lucky to be at a place like KKR that cares so much about the junior development. Just in the past 6 months, we've had 40 new joiners at the analyst associate level out of 99 for the year globally join. And look, like, it's definitely not easy starting a new job for anyone, but especially in a virtual world, it takes longer to get up to speed. You miss out on building relationships and hearing, you know, the bullpen chatter that I was talking about before. That's all critical things to really build up your understanding of the business and your day-to-day tasks. KKR is trying, you know, exceptionally hard to, you know, mitigate all of those things that we're missing out on to ensure that we're still able to build connections. Like, they have different breakout groups and this thing called KKR Connections, where we are encouraged to, we're assigned, you know, somebody else across the world to connect with virtually and make sure that we're able to build that relationship. But yeah, I mean, across my peer set, I would say that people in private equity are having a similar experience. I think that some firms are kind of getting ready to go back to New York after Labor Day, but KKR is definitely playing it on the safer end and really have just communicated they are, you know, their biggest priority is employee safety and happiness. And they've been great with surveying all of us and especially at the team level, making sure that we all feel really comfortable and happy to the extent that we can in this environment.
Jess, I started at Salomon Brothers as a financial analyst, and I worked pretty long hours my first few years. Let's say 60 hours a week. I would work Saturdays and Sundays. What is your experience like in terms of hours, in terms of stress, in terms of work effort and performance? Are you still busting your ass as hard? Is the stress down? Are you able to plan your day better? Is there no, like, hours where you're just hanging around waiting to get assignments? What is the life of an analyst today, particularly under COVID specifically?
Yeah, good question. I would say, you know, at KKR, there's definitely no FaceTime, which has been a huge surprise and great benefit for me, especially coming from a year in banking where that was kind of the norm. So, you know, even if we're at the office, if you have nothing to do, you're kind of expected to leave, which is great. But, you know, it's still stressful during the day because your managing director can come up to your computer and sit behind you and say, hey, run this and this and this and let me know what this is when you're trying to get something else out. And they can't really do that now, which is really great, I think, for, you know, principals and down to be able to just really focus on the task at hand. And when somebody reaches out to you, they really, really need it versus somebody just walking by your desk and grabbing your eye and making sure that, you know, you can run something for them. So that's great. And then the other thing is that, yeah, stress levels, I would say, on the whole, and my team are way down. And of course, you know, we're still super busy, and especially with, you know, the acquisition of Global Atlantic, we were working flat out weekends, you know, late into the night, et cetera. But for the most part, you have you know, a lot more flexibility in your day. If you have an hour where something doesn't need to go out immediately, you can do a workout, or you can go for a walk, or, you know, have lunch with your family or call a friend, which is just, that just doesn't happen in the office. So I know that I'm definitely going to miss that when we go back, and it's been a treat to spend all this time with my family here. But hopefully they're going to be able to implement different ideas for the future of work. And I know that there's already a team within KKR who's working on that, whether it's having, you know, 2 days a week that are optional, or, you know, maybe it's working virtual for July and August, or a few weeks in the summer to give people increased flexibility. But I do think that all in all, there will be a positive change that comes out of this for us.
Josh Hagani, when you hear your sister talking about her experience as a financial analyst, I know that you were a financial analyst, and you know, you didn't love certain aspects about that program. What, how do you think that the program is, these programs have evolved to be more successful, and do you think you would have enjoyed it more in this remote learning approach versus being on the trading desk at Citi?
I think Jess summarized it pretty well. I think the ability to, to just take a moment away from the desk and to live your life is really key. And I think that, with more remote and more effort going in that direction, not having to be at your desk surrounded by your bosses from, 8:30 in the morning until 1 a.m. at night is a really good thing. I think that also, I do think it's very group specific. I mean, my group was an amazing experience, but it was definitely, throw in the deep end experience. I think seeing a lot of my other friends who had, analyst jobs across Wall Street, everybody had a different experience. And it was, I think if I were to go back in time, I'm not saying I would change it, but, I think my advice to someone would be to really focus on the group, not on the company, right? Get a lot more specific into the people you're working with and the things that you're doing.
I agree with that completely. I think it marries very much who you work for specifically, not so much the firm or even what the industry job is.
Yeah.
Josh, you've gone now from a two-year analyst program to becoming an entrepreneur and all the complexities that go with that. I imagine the last 6 months have been just incredibly invigorating, complicated, and joyful. Can you describe what it's like to be an entrepreneur versus a two-year analyst, what you're learning, and how you find it fulfilling?
Yeah, so I just want to say that in between being an analyst and my business in VietShare, I worked for a company called Vertical Harvest, which was a small hydroponic startup here in Wyoming. And so that was a really good bridge between having a very structured work to then doing something on my own. I got to look at owners and, people making decisions and how they were doing it for their small business. And then I just think it gave me a lot of tools and ways to think through things. I think the way I would summarize it is, now everything I'm working on has, the outcome of that is, is mine. I'm not talking from a financial standpoint. I'm talking from more from my work is my ownership.
Move
right?
it so the sun is still on your face. There you go.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Josh.
Oh, okay. And no, it's all good. I think it's been amazingly fun. Obviously, there have been moments where, we definitely freak out, and I think there's going to be many more of those moments ahead. But, overall, I we're in a really good place at the moment, and we've got we have all of the KPIs and the things that we're looking for to determine that this has been success and sort of go to that next level. Yeah, hopefully that answered that question.
Okay. Justin, you are taking a gap year, and I think it's imperative that you use this year for personal growth. You've decided to be my intern on What Happens Next. How would you describe the position as a way of building your skills, learning? Is it what you want? And, you know, if you were recommending to other kids in, who are also on gap years, how should they think about how they should spend their time in their gap year?
That's a really great question, Larry. So as for my current internship with What Happens Next, I think it's really important to get some work experience because for the past 13 years, all I've known is school. And so I found many of the opportunities from just scheduling to finding new speakers to proposing and pitching them to you, Larry, have all been quite new to me. And I've learned so much just through trial and error and understanding what is best for the program. So as for the gap year in general, I think a gap year is a really great opportunity to trial something. For example, I've always been interested in going into finance, and a gap year is an incredible opportunity for me to dip my toes in the water and look for an internship in that field for a year and then angle my path in college towards pursuing it. Or if for some reason I don't find it as interesting, reassessing before I get to college and then deciding what direction I want to take my career in.
Okay. All right. It's at this point of the show where I like to go around and ask people what they're optimistic about. I have to say that this show has had almost no pessimism other than Jeremy's concern about the mental health for some young adults. Away from that, has been quite positive. Needless to say, we're still going to go with a positive angle. So I'm going to start this out with Charlotte. Charlotte, could you comment on something that you're optimistic about?
Yeah, definitely. I'm super optimistic about the possibility for this technology that we have now, especially with schools and how it can kind of unify the world. I had a great experience, as I stated, in high school, and I definitely see that this technology is becoming more present and it can unify people in countries such as South Korea, United States, wherever. People can get together and learn at the same time, and I feel like that's going to be something super exciting. It's scary right now, but it'll be great in the future.
Super. Okay. Hannah Bernstein, what are you optimistic about?
I think it's going to be a great semester where kids are more used to online format and teachers have more time to prepare a curriculum that's suited for online. And I do think that, you know, kids will be able to find ways to be around each other in safe ways, hopefully.
Okay. Josh?
I'm optimistic about remote work and the technology that allow for that. I think primarily because of the efficiency it brings to business, but also, you know, as we heard on the call, an improvement in quality of life.
Jess?
Similar to Josh, I think that this time has really showed that you can get work done from wherever, and it will often be better than previously sitting in the office, and that is hugely exciting for somebody who is just embarking on their career, and that, you know, that could potentially be a possibility going forward, even working at a large corporate company.
Kyle?
I'm optimistic about the future of our mitigation of the coronavirus, and, you know, I've been following New York, and I think it's a good example of a place where if you listen to the rules and you wear the mask, we can get this thing down and hopefully a vaccine comes soon.
Okay. Jonathan Bernstein, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic that the COVID crisis will be overall a better thing that will impact my life. It is a tragedy that my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college is not going to be the greatest, but I think it's going to really set us on a better track. So, yeah, that's what I'm optimistic about.
Audrey, what are you optimistic about?
I'd say I'm most optimistic about young people's ability to make change, especially after this time. It was so awesome hearing everyone's unique perspectives and kind of the ways they've been able to create change in those areas. So I'm really excited for the future.
Okay. Anna Schell?
Something Jonathan kind of touched on earlier, but I'm very optimistic about how young people will appreciate time with people and especially time outside more, knowing that, you know, those special moments you can't take for granted because how fast they could be taken away.
Okay. Lauren, Teichholz?
I'm optimistic about schools starting soon, whether they're online or in person, just because I think it'll be really good to talk to other classmates and get to know my teachers.
Justin Benjamin, what are you optimistic about?
After hearing such fascinating perspectives today, I'm really optimistic that people, whether in college or they're taking time off, will find new ways to be resourceful in this time and discover different methods to pursue their passions.
Great. I want to call on my co-host, Rick Banks. Rick, what did you make of all these kids today? What are you both optimistic about, and what did you learn from these 11 kids?
Oh my, I don't know that we have enough time for that sort of big question, but I think that it is inspiring to hear the range of opinions and the ingenuity and the resourcefulness and the resilience of our callers. So I think that all of the older generation can take heart that the young people are bringing a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. Okay, so that ends our program for today. I just wanted to again reiterate what's happening next week. We're going to be talking about education, and we've got speakers on testing, on data collection, on how to improve calculus teaching by using online approaches. We're also going to talk about religion education, and we're going to talk about foster kids and education as well. So I think it's going to be a very exciting discussion. In 3 weeks, we're going to have a discussion also about pandemic literature, and so I encourage everyone to read Catherine Ann Porter's short novella, Pale Horse, Pale Rider. Okay, that's it. I want to thank all my speakers, my 11 kids, Jeremy and Jennifer, too, and all of you listeners for listening in. Thank you very much. You can disconnect and have a great day. Thanks for everyone's participation. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Larry.
You're very welcome.